What's up, my freaks, sharpness geeks, and purveyors of stabby goodness? Welcome to the Knife Freak Show. My name is Jonathan McNeese, and I am joined by my co-host, Mr. Chase Boatwright.
How you doing today?
I am good. And as those of you that are on YouTube can see, we are also joined today by a special guest. Today we have with us Mr. Bobby Branton. How are you doing, Bobby?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
Doing great. Doing great. Tickled to have a guest on here, and especially one of your caliber. So we're going to have a good time today.
At Ernest Emerson, that's a hard act to follow, man. You put me in a bind.
No, man, you're good. We're just going to keep going up here. All right.
Yeah, Ernest's good people.
Yeah. I'd always known, you know, from a distance, and everybody I'd talked to, and getting to actually talk to him and kind of getting to know him was, yeah, it just confirmed everything I'd ever heard about him, that what a good person he is. So that was fantastic. All right. So I'm going to read in just the high points. It's kind of like it was with Ernie. If we did the whole rundown, we'd probably be on here for the whole podcast, just doing the highlights. So I'm going to hit the high points of the highlights here, and then we'll get into some of this stuff. So, Bobby, started making knives and studied under, I would call it studied under, you can correct me if that's not appropriate, Bobby, but, George Heron, and then, James Crowell for the bladesmithing stuff.
And right.
And, James McAvoy for when you started getting into the throwing knives, all three were some big influences on you. And then I believe Walter Brenn kind of factors in there somewhere as well.
Harry McAvoy.
Hey, okay. All right, I don't know where I got James from, but Bobby is also a journeyman bladesmith, correct?
That's correct.
All right, and he is an author. He has authored several articles for Blade Magazine. He's authored a book, which is essentially what I would consider the Bible on knife throwing. We'll get into that a little bit more in a little bit. He's a 3-time inductee into the International Throwing Knife Hall of Fame, correct?
That's correct.
All right. And then that's pretty cool because I didn't even know you could be inducted more than once. So were those like different categories?
Yeah, different categories.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to hear more about that in a moment too then, because that's freaking awesome. All right. And he's received the Blade Magazine Industry Achievement Award, which by my understanding is a pretty high award. Like that's, you have to have really made an impact on the industry to receive that. So that's a fantastic. And obviously you've had you've also worked, and we'll get into this some more later, of course. I'm sure you're used to this questions and stuff, but he has worked on in film with like major films with Selma Hayek for the main person that he coached and stuff with film. He did for years and years. It was over what, 25, 26 years you did exhibitions at Blade Show, I believe, Bobby.
Yeah, 24 years.
24 years, so
consecutively.
Yep. So Bobby's one of those guys that's been there and done that, and got the awards and the accolades to prove it. So really tickled to have him on here today. We're going to dig in a little bit and see if we can get some more info on some of these really interesting topics. So you have anything to add or to jump off with, Chase?
I mean, as far as this is more of a personal anecdotal, you know, sort of thing. But I mean, there's two names I've known since about 2003 when I was like 8 years old, the first time I got Smoky Mountain Knife Works. So sort of the first two names in the knife industry that I really knew. One was Ken Onion because he was hot and heavy with all his Kershaw designs at that point. And the other one was Bobby with all the stuff he had in Smoky Mountain Knife Works at the time. And so it's just really cool. You know, he's a guy I've seen everywhere from forums to, you know, everybody. It's one of those names that I've just seen for a long, long time.
And yeah. And I'll go on so far as to say too, that I feel like Bobby's probably one of those guys that has, one of the most, has the most friends, or, you know, probably one of the people that has the biggest number of friends in the industry of anybody I could think of. Like I can't think of anybody that would have an ill word to say about Bobby. So that speaks a lot. And I think Bobby, you and I have known each other for what, probably 12 to 15 years, somewhere in there.
Yeah, quite a while.
Yeah.
Quite a while.
It's been a while. We won't go into the details that got us there, but it all worked out in the long run, didn't it?
But we turned out to be great friends, you know.
Yeah.
You know, just out of happenstance, I guess. And I always enjoyed visiting with you and Amy at every Blade show and stuff, kind of one of the highlights. And
likewise.
I tell people you have to catch people sometime when they're at the booth or the table when you're walking around, because, you know, even for the rest of the weekend, you may go back by again, or you may not get a chance to go back by again, and so you may never see them. So I always try to make sure that you and Amy are on one of my first stops, so I make sure that I don't, you know, get pass you by somehow during the show.
And we've always appreciated it. We've always, like, Bobby, like I said, having known each other that long, Bobby's watched as, you know, I've gone from custom maker that, you know, probably some stuff he probably was given the side. He'd be too nice to say anything, but probably some stuff that he might have had questions about the some of my abilities from way back then on the table.
I don't know why, but I've always kind of, you know, why I followed you, because I liked you and I liked what you were doing. And so I was, I don't know why I would be so proud of you, but you know, I am kind of proud of you, because I know your roots.
Yeah.
And so I know you came up, you know, OG, you know, you came up the hard way, you paid your dues, you know, whatever that is. But you know, you did everything right, and you came up you know, the right way. You worked hard, and you and Amy both, and you know, it was kinda fun to watch both of you grow into what you've become now. And I could have never imagined that, you know, when you first started out, you know.
Me either.
But evidently you had that dream, and you made the dream happen. So that's pretty cool.
Well, I appreciate that. It's,
you know, like you say, only in America, man. And, you know, the knife industry is what you make of it, you know.
100%.
And you can go as low-key. I've always kind of considered myself low-key. In the sense that I've never been, or never have I never sought to be the internet sensation of the week or the month or anything. I've just always kind of just kept my nose to the grindstone and tried to stay out of trouble and, you know, and I try to learn. I'm 68 years old and I try to learn something every day. Mm-hmm. And I can learn from anybody, you know. And so my head is not that big that I can't humble myself and learn something from somebody starting out.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of a cool place to be.
Yep. Slow and steady wins the race, they say. So
exactly.
Yep. Very cool. Well, now, like I said, a lot of your career has revolved around the throwing stuff, but let's back up a little bit before we get into that. And, give however detailed answer you want to give as far as kind of how you got into knives. Like, you know, I kind of know about your, you know, your rural roots and stuff. Kind of, I think we've got a lot of similarities there with some of the ways we grew up and stuff like that. So give us a rundown of kind of what led you to the point of becoming a knife maker, if you would.
Number one, I grew up in a slaughterhouse. My uncle had a slaughterhouse next door on, you know, commercial. And so I worked in there, you know, starting, you know, sweeping guts around, you know, hog guts, cow guts around on the floor and stuff, cleaning up and doing stuff like that. And, you know, watching them, I used to be fascinated watching them sharpen those knives on the steel. They would have a steel on their side, you know, next to their knife, and they'd pull it out and they'd whip that thing back and forth. Man, I was just fascinated. And I learned how to do that and just, you know, learn how to work with knives and, you know, how to be safe with knives. But, you know, fast forward a few years forward, I used to work on a tugboat. And so we had a lot of time to sit down and read in between, you know, pulling ships in and out of the harbor. And so I had a book on swimming because I was doing a lot of swimming for exercise, which is a good thing when you work on a tugboat. And a friend of mine had a book on knife making. And so when I finished my swimming book, he said, "Hey, man, can I read that?" I said, "Sure." He said, "Here, you can read this book here. And so I took his book and I started flipping through it. And I was an auto mechanic for years before I became a chief engineer on a tugboat. And so I was always good at working with my hands. I said, yeah, I can do that. You know, it's basic machines and hand-eye coordination. And I think I'd give that a try. And during one of my days before coming to work, I would always go and swim first, then come back. And I had a little bit of extra time. And I went through downtown Charleston. And I was just going through the old slave market, you know, at, looking at, checking out all the vendors and stuff. And there was a little hole in the wall knife shop there called the Blade and Barrel. And I went in there, and that was the first time in my life that I've ever seen a handmade knife. And she had handmade knives from George Heron and probably most of the South Carolina knife makers. She had some knives by John Nelson Cooper and just a variety of stuff. And she had some books and copies of Blade magazine. And so I ended up buying, like a John Nelson Cooper Bowie for like $200, a big massive Bowie. And I bought some, I don't think she had any Heron knives for sale at that time when I went back. And so I started flipping through these books and I found that Mr. Heron lived in Aiken and I was getting ready to go to Atlanta. And so I would have to go through Aiken. And so I called him up and say, hey, can I come through? And I'd like to look at your knives and check out your shop and just to kind of see what this stuff is all about. And so they invited me to stop in, and which I did. And so he took me in the old quick little shop tour. And he was still up in Aiken, South Carolina at that time. And so we went in his house and he was telling me that they were getting ready to go for a show. So they had some inventory there. And so he had this big deerskin pelt on top of a coffee table. And he kind of whipped that thing up like a matador would, whip out a cape, and fling it off to the side. And I looked there and just a table full of these most beautiful knives I've ever seen in my life. And I was very fortunate that they allowed me to buy, I think, maybe two or three knives since, they were getting ready to go to a show. And so I bought really my first customs there. And so, we just kind of just struck up a friendship. They were very easy. And they kind of, knew what I wanted and everything. So he invited me to come back up. And he kind of told me, what equipment to get and things like that. And so I went back home and I had bought some knife kits from one of the suppliers back then. And so I put those two knife kits together, and I can't wait to go back up here to see Mr. Heron, And he kind of looked at him, he said, did you grind the blade on these? And I said, no, sir, I sure didn't. I said, these are knife kits. He just looked at me straight in the eye and he said, if you're going to make knives, you're going to want to grind your own knives. And he said, so you need to go ahead as soon as you can get that grinder and get going. And I said, okay, I laughed. And I said, okay. And so I went back home and for whatever reason, I had found Walter Brenn lived in Walterboro at the time. And so I called him up and asked him if I could come down and look at his shop. And I did. And during that time, he showed me his Beta grinder. And so he wrote down all the information. He said, you need to order this, this, and this. And so I ordered all of that stuff and went back home and cobbled together my first knife. And it was actually the ugliest thing I ever seen in my life, but it was my first knife, and I still have it. And so I just kind of progressed from there. I would go back and forth to Walter's shop once in a while, and I'd go up to Mr. Heron's probably a little bit more. And Mr. Heron was very generous, and we got to be friends real quick. And so he would you know, he'd take a lot more time with you. You know, he had the time to do it because he was doing it full time. And it was just super, super cool, laid back. And, you know, he might even give you a couple of knives to make a pattern off of or something like that. And so, you know, Mr. Heron was pretty much like the grandfather of South Carolina knife makers. And so he was eager to help anybody and everybody. And so that really gave me a good boost. And, you know, he'd give you a good, honest critique and, you know, tell you what you need to work on, what you need to do. And so he just, you know, just kind of mentored me along. And it was, you know, kind of the rest is history, I guess. You know, we maintained a great relationship and friendship until he passed away.
That is so cool. I bet there are not many, if anybody else, that can say that they bought a George Heron knife from his living room, from him in his living room.
Yeah, and the cool thing about it is, you know, what's the chances of a wannabe knife maker having two, not one, but two world-class knife makers within 100 miles of them?
Yeah.
I mean, that was just kind of dumb luck.
Well,
yeah. And, you know, Walter and I, we got to be friends too. And I actually went to my first knife show down in Orlando with Walter. Walter rode with me. I had a Camaro at the time. And I'm the kind of person that when I get ready to go somewhere, I don't play around. I want to get there. You know, I can have fun once I get there, but, you know, I'm going to drive straight through. I'm going to get gas and go to the restroom, get back in, and go. And Walton used to make fun of me, and he said, "Boy, you're going to kill me. You're not even going to stop to eat. You just want to get gas and go." And so anyway, we got down to Orlando and all, and they had this a nice little knife show down there. And I'm sitting at Walter's table, and they had some, like, collections on the outer perimeter, like sort of like they do at Blade Show. And I seen this guy, and everybody kind of started whispering around me, you know, and said, look. And I'm looking around, you know, who am I looking at? And lo and behold, it was Bo Randall walking around looking at the displays. And my tongue got probably the size of a grapefruit. I couldn't even talk. I wanted to go up there and say hello, and I couldn't even get words out of my mouth. And that's how, you know, awestruck I was, you know, seeing, you know, basically the man himself. Every book I picked up at the time, you know, he was in it somewhere in there. And so that was pretty cool. I always kind of regretted that I never did get a chance to really talk to him, but I just wasn't able.
I can relate. I understand. I don't know. I think it's, you know, it's industry specific, very industry specific fame, but like it still gets you, you know what I mean? Like you don't think about it, but like, I mean, we know in reality, they're just dudes that make knives or whatever, that made, you know, and built knife companies, but still, you feel like you're seeing a big time celebrity. Cause to us, they are, you know,
You know, it's the same thing with Ernie. You know, I've known Ernie a long time, and, you know, we even did a little collaboration, you know, he was very generous and, you know, let me lending his name to a throwing knife that I designed. And so, you know, just like you said, you know, he's so busy at the shows and stuff. And, you know, I'm not one to force myself on people. And so I don't get to get the FaceTime that I'd like to get with him all the time. And just like at this year at Blade Show, I couldn't get by his table. And we happened to run into each other in the elevator going up to the rooms and stuff. And, you know, we were trying to talk and I needed to get off on my floor and they were trying to get back up to their room and stuff. And so that was the only time I got to talk to him at the show and stuff, you know, trying to catch up with him and things.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you get, you know, those are the people you read about when you're first starting out and read about in the magazine. So you really look up to them. And when you see them in person, you know, and you finally get to meet them and you realize they're just people just like us, you know, and it's cool feeling.
Yeah.
And,
I've definitely had, I'm more introverted, like you said you were, Robbie, before we started. Jonathan doesn't know anything about that, but I've definitely had that feeling. You know, when I first started going to Blade Show, I would see all these people and I was walking, you know, with my wife or whatever and be like, oh, that's Walter Brand, that's so-and-so, you know, and like pointing at them, but not actually going up and talking to them. But in recent years, I've like kind of made myself get out of my shell and go talk to the man.
You have to, you know. And I mean, I tell people the cool thing about being in this industry for 40 something years, and I can probably go to a knife maker shop in every state in the United States and probably some in different countries, you know. And I could just call them up and say, hey, I'd like to come over and, you know, can you show me this, or I'm in town for this, you know. And they would invite me in their shop and probably invite me into their home, you know, to spend the night or to have supper or something like that. And so I probably have more friends scattered across the United States than I do right here in my own hometown.
Yep. That's another one of the really cool things about this industry is that you get, you know, it's not people that, like you said, you may get, you know, you may get 2 minutes or less with them a year at a show or something, but then you still consider each other friends, you know. It's still.
Oh yeah, you know. You pick up where you left off that last time, mm-hmm. You know, and that's kind of the good thing about Facebook. I get to, you know, stay in contact with you and you know, and the different people and all my friends on Facebook that I don't normally get to see at shows and stuff. And so, you know, you get to kind of keep up with them and all. Then when you see them at a show. And it just, you kind of get to rekindle that friendship, you know. And I have a lot of friends, and I feel very blessed to have the friends that I have in the industry.
Yeah, that's one of the best things about the industry, and then the fact that it revolves around knives that we all love is even better. So that kind of takes us up to, you know, how you got into knife making in general. So since throwing knives is a big part of your story, tell us how you ended up kind of transitioning, or not totally transitioning, but how you kind of got into the throwing knife thing.
Well, I went to my first Blade Show. I think it was at the Holiday Inn World's Fair at the, that was the name of the hotel in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I think it was their first year. They had moved, I think, maybe from Louisville, Kentucky or something. And so that was their first year in Knoxville. And I think even back then, they boasted like 700 tables.
Wow.
And at the time, I ended up being a collector before I became a maker. And even when I was first starting out making, I was still collecting pretty heavily because I had a pretty good job, you know, as a chief engineer on a tugboat. So I had a lot of extra cash and stuff that I could spend on this hobby. And so I had a pretty good collection of Ruana knives out of Montana. And so I got a display table at the Blade Show. And so I kind of had like a home base there. And so I could, you know, put everything under the display cases, and I could go wander around and start visiting people. And that's when I started making friends and stuff. I met Bob Loveless there, and, you know, Buster Warinsky, and, you know, Jimmy Lyle, and, you know, those were my idols back then, you know. And yeah, you know, they're the biggest names in knife making, you know, even still today.
Yeah.
And so, you know, get to see all of these people. And so at that show, I met Harry McAvoy, and he was doing his throwing demonstration out. And I always had bad luck with trying to throw knives. I was trying to throw at plywood and stuff like that. And I had little crap knives because I didn't know anything about real throwing knives. And so I bought some True Balance throwing knives from him. And so after I got home, I ordered some more. And so we began corresponding back and forth. And back then, you know, you had to wait until like 6 o'clock before the rates would go down in the next time zone and stuff. And he would always get on me if I called him too early. He said, wait till 6 o'clock, the rates go down. And, you know, he would send postcard letters and all of that stuff. And so I hit off with a friendship with him. And, you know, he saw I was a struggling knife maker. And so I asked him, I said, you know, I said, I don't know anything about design and throwing knives. I said, would you design four throwing knives for me to get started with? And I paid him for them. And so he, you know, he designed the throwing knives for me and told me how to, you know, get them made and stuff. Either cut them out on the bandsaw or laser or whatever. I don't know if laser had come into play yet. But, you know, I cut a bunch of them out and he told me, you know, how to harden them and stuff. And so when I started throwing, you know, the True Balance knives and stuff, I started having more success. And I go, okay, that's the secret ingredient, you know, getting a good throwing knife. And so at that time, I was still working on the tugboats and stuff for a few more years. And so I didn't need the extra income or anything. And so I could treat it as a hobby. And so that allowed me to try to hone my skills and everything and continually get better. And then, you know, one of the next job that I had, I ended up working a lot of hours, and I had like three jobs. You know, I had a regular job I went to. When I got home in the afternoon, I would bush hog and do stuff like that with my tractor and all to make extra money. And then I would go out to the shop and cut out knives on the bandsaw. And so at that time, I could make throwing knives. I had gotten where I could make the throwing knives pretty quickly. And I started getting a reputation as a maker of throwing knives. And because out of the, everybody at the Blade Show, nobody wanted to make throwing knives because throwing knives are kind of like the red-haired stepchild of the knife industry. They were $50, $75, and, you know, everybody goes to the show, they, you know, they're making $100, $200, $300 knives and stuff. And so I had the luxury of, you know, people knowing who I was and liking me, and I would have makers in the show. Somebody would come up and say, hey, do you have any throwing knives? And they would just point over there across, go over there, see that guy over there with the hat on. And so they would actually send people to my table to buy throwing knives. And so I had the whole room basically as salesmen for me. And so that was pretty cool too, since I was the only guy doing it. You know, it's kind of like shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah.
And so, and the throwing knives kind of worked into my schedule for, you know, making knives 2 or 3 hours a night. You know, I could make a couple of throwing knives where it would take me a week to make a hunting knife. And so the more that I got into knife throwing, I saw that as an opportunity to educate people, number one. And I had people, you know, well, I got these nice knives from you. Where can I throw them? And so I had some friends of mine that one of them was McElroy's son after McElroy passed away. And they said, well, why don't you have a knife throwing tournament here at your house? You know, you got a lot of land and everything. And I said, yeah, that's a good idea. And so I started really getting heavy into the knife throwing and looking up, you know, like the who's who in the knife throwing world, the professional knife throwers, because those were the people that I really admired. And I could really care less about throwing at a chunk of wood. And I like the kind of the glamour and stuff of watching a professional knife thrower just kind of flow through the, you know, and act, whatever you want to call it. And so that was pretty cool. It just, you know, it just kind of just escalated from there, and, you know, started making more and more throwing knives, and I'd have a tournament once a year. And then Blade, you know, 1996 Blade, when Dan Dennehy was doing the demonstration at the Blade Show, and when he retired in 1996 from that, they asked me if I would do it, and I said sure. And so that was another venue, you know, for me to get customers and stuff and to educate people. And so it just kind of fit into my my lifestyle at the time. And so I basically didn't make too many, you know, hunters and boot knives and stuff for a while, unless, you know, they were local people and stuff like that. And you know, and this whole time too, I was, you know, wanting to be a bladesmith. I didn't really have any ambitions to be a master bladesmith at the time. And so I started forging because I wanted to be able to make a knife from basically scratch, you know, a piece of raw steel laying out in the yard or something, you know, kind of like, I tell people knife makers were one of the first recyclers, you know. We could take items and turn them into artistic type blades and stuff. And so I worked real hard on that. And the closest bladesmith that I could find was Jim Crowell out of Arkansas. And so I drove from, my wife and I, we drove from Allendale, South Carolina to Mountain View, Arkansas in like 18 hours. Mm. And so I spent a week with him, and he was boning me up, you know, kind of getting me ready for the test and stuff, to take my journeyman's test. And so I passed it there in his shop, and the next year at Blade Show, I had to display the amount of knives needed to get my journeyman's certificate. And I just never, once I reached that, I never had any ambitions to become a master smith, because I saw that I wasn't a very fast, you know, knife maker. And being out there by yourself, you know, with hot steel and equipment that can tear your hands off and stuff like that, it just, I figured I need to try to protect my body as much as possible.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I started having, you know, knee issues and things like that. I said, I'll be better off, you know, sitting in a chair grinding and doing stock removal. And so that's how I kind of evolved back into between making throwing knives and making fighters and boot knives and fillet knives and whatever. And so I kind of started back to that direction. And then some opportunities came my way to, you know, I eventually purchased True Balance throwing knives, but my knees at that time had gotten so bad. I just, I brought the company back from basically nothing and got it into the 21st century, got it, you know, online with the internet, and was able, instead of, you know, sending a letter to place an order and waiting for the order form to come and going back and forth with that, I made it where people can buy throwing knives using PayPal and whatever, you know, over the internet. Mm-hmm. And but I kind of did myself a disservice. I got too much business. So I had more work than I could possibly do. And then when my knees started deteriorating, I just said, you know, I want to see somebody carry this on. I could, probably could have sold the company to a larger company, but I did not want to see production go to China. And so I told my wife, I said, you know, I'm going to sell True Bow, but I want to handpick my successor. And so I just kind of kept looking around, putting out feelers and stuff. And then one day this guy called me up and said, you know, do you really want to sell True Bow? I said, yeah. He said, you want to see it come back to Michigan? I said, yeah, that'd be great. He said, well, I know some guys. And he said, I'll talk to them. And so we met and everything over the phone and stuff and worked out a deal. And so I sold it, and they came down and picked up, you know, all the assets and everything, the blades and stuff that I had and stuff to make them with. And so I became great friends with them, and I'm still kind of act as a mentor and a historian of the True Balance knives. And so it was kind of pretty much at that point, I'd got one knee replaced, and I was getting ready to get the other one replaced, and then COVID hit.
Mm.
And so when that hit, you know, nobody wanted to be near a hospital at that time. And so I put off getting my second knee done, and I really regret doing that because now it's in real bad shape.
Yeah.
And so ever since I sold True Bile and everything, I pretty much have been kind of semi-retired. And so I had some orders I wanted to clean up on my books. And so it took me a couple more years to get all of those taken care of. And then once I got all my orders taken care of, I just started making knives and just, you know, looking for buyers for them. And I've been pretty lucky. I have enough people contact me if I post a picture or something. And so, and like I told my wife, I said, I haven't had to eat a knife in 40 years. So, you know, somebody's going to buy it. It may not sell today or tomorrow or next month, but somebody will eventually buy it. But I've been pretty blessed, and I have a few people that try to buy everything that I make and everything, which isn't a whole lot, but it's good for me to be able to sell stuff pretty easily.
Absolutely. You've built up a customer base and a following and a clientele over all these years, so that's kind of paying off for you now. So
yeah, great. Exactly.
Yeah. That's really cool. So let's jump into the, I think it's super interesting to me, and I'm sure to a lot of people, everybody likes to, you know, hear about Hollywood. So tell us about the movie scene and how that came about.
Well, I received an email one day from France, and it was a production company, and a movie production company, and they sent me a letter simply saying, you know, we checked you out over the internet, and you look like the person that we would want to hire to do a job, and would you like to would you like to train an actress for a movie? And, you know, naturally I said yes, and as luck would have it, in 2003, I started having trouble with my knees at work, and so I knew I wouldn't be able to work on the outside like I did. I was in charge of buildings and grounds. And so my wife told me to, you need to go ahead and go full-time knife making, because if you don't, you're going to regret it. And she said, now's a good time. She said, I got insurance here. You know, she started working at the same place. I got her job there. And so she had good benefits and stuff. And so I was able to, drop my insurance and pick hers up. And so she said, you know, you go ahead and strike out on your own and let's see what you can do. And so just before I quit, I'd like to try to, you know, have all my ducks in a row. And I had been talking to Walter, and, you know, Walter's knives back then were like $2,000, $2,500 for real basic stuff. And, you know, probably I think the least expensive knife he had was probably like $1,500. And I said, Walter, I said, this is when MedTech was starting to become popular. And I think Rob Simonich was the only person that was doing MedTechs at the time, other than, you know, Ken Onion had done the MedTech with some folders and stuff. But Rob Simonich started doing the fixed blades. And so Rob and I, you know, we had become friends. And so he was nice enough to allow me to pick his brain. And so I came up with this crazy idea that I wanted to make some fixed blades for the guys that were going to Afghanistan and Iraq. So Walter and I, when I would go up there, I'd go up there sometimes before work, and Walter and I would go to the Cracker Barrel for breakfast. And so while we were having breakfast one day, I said, Walter, I said, you know, there's a lot of soldiers out there that simply can't afford your knives. And he said, yeah, Bobby, I know that. And I said, would you allow me to license one of your designs and let me do a semi-custom version of it and make it affordable for the soldiers? And Walter said, Bobby, I think that'd be a great idea. And so we scribbled something on a napkin, you know, kind of was making our plans on a napkin in the Cracker Barrel. And so he already had a design in mind, which was, you know, kind of a non-guarded version of his model number two. And so that was the one we picked. And so, you know, he kind of helped me out through the process and everything. And then you're trying to figure out how to scale this thing up a little bit. And so he gave me some good ideas about, you know, water jet cutting and things like that and things that we could do to make it quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had kind of dabbled in CNC just a little bit. I had an old Bridgeport that was converted into a CNC. And so my buddy Larry Davidson out of Texas, he basically had the same machine and the same controls. And so he helped me talk to a friend of mine, Dick Atkinson. Dick had these old machines that he would retrofit, then sell them. And so Larry knew Dick well and everything. And so he kind of helped put the deal together. And so I got the machine to my house and I'm sitting, you know, how the hell am I going to pull this off? I know nothing about CNC. I'm totally terrified of it. And so I got it home. So a good friend of mine and yours, Larry owed him a good favor. So he made it possible for Larry Davidson to fly down and spend a week in my shop.
Mm.
So Larry came and, you know, he did all the programming and helped me draw everything up. So he had me cutting parts in like 2 days. And so I was making the handles for the MidTech because they needed to be 3D.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I did all of that stuff. And so I got the MidTechs up and running. And, you know, that's another part of history and stuff. And so I got a lot of publicity off of that. And then about the time I was kind of getting into the MidTech thing, that's when the people sent me the letter wanting me to train the actress. And they wanted me to make all the knives for the movie.
Wow.
And so the CNC came in very handy at that time. And so Larry Davidson helped me program, you know, the knives into my computer. And then in the meantime, I had to fly out to Los Angeles to train the actress. And they rented us a ballroom in the hotel that we were staying at. And they had their people build a target to my spec. And so my wife and I, we flew out to L.A. And so I carried all of these knives with me and stuff. And so we went out there and basically trained her over like a 2-day period. And so that was pretty cool. Then at the end of it, she said, Bobby, are you going to Mexico with me? She said, to train me there. I said, well, I said, nobody has asked me anything like that. I said, but you have more power than I do. I said, if you need me and want me there, I said, just tell them, you know. And I said, I'm available, you know, to go down. And so after that, we, you know, we got back home and all, and almost, you know, like a day later, and when I was checking in with them, they called me back up and they said, you know, we need you to go to Mexico City, you know, for a week or so. And I said, well, okay. And so in the meantime, they said, well, can you have some knives ready? And so I had already had the knives programmed into the computer and stuff. And so I made some throwing knives and I had to send them to California to like a warehouse where they had to, you know, bundle all this stuff up together for the movie and ship it into Mexico. And so I went down to Mexico City and they had a sound stage set aside for me to train her in. And so, you know, they'd have a car come pick me up every day and take me to the studio. And then she'd show up at a certain time and I'd train her, you know, for an hour or two. And then I would go and work on the movie set with them as a technical advisor. And I'd stand behind the monitors, you know, where the director and the producers and all of that, they would sit there and watch the scenes as they unfold. So as soon as the scene was shot, they would call me over and they would say, okay, watch this. Does this look realistic? Is she doing everything right? And stuff like that. And so that was pretty cool, you know, being able to do that. And so I did that for, I stayed down there for almost a week and came back home. And then they called me again and they said, we need you to go to Durango, Mexico, which was a little bit more on the west coast. And it was way out away from Mexico City. So this was like totally different world going out there. And it happened to be like an old studio, I mean, an old piece of property that I think John Wayne owned it at one time, and they would use it to film westerns on this property. And so they flew me down there, and there was no actors or actresses there. It was only what they call second unit people, stunt people and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I went out there. We went out on location and out in the woods and stuff, and we filmed a bunch of knife throwing sequences out there. And they had stunt doubles and things like that. And so I had to show them how to hold a knife. And just basically they just wanted to get to the part where it released out of their hand. And they would cut the film at that. And then I would do my thing. And then they would put my throwing, you know, make it look like she threw the knife that I stuck in the log or whatever. And then I had to knock over some bean cans or something with a throwing knife, you know, for a particular scene.
Yeah.
So I did that for a couple of days too. And so that was pretty cool.
That's awesome. A pretty unique experience that not a lot of people can claim. Cool.
That's probably definitely one of the highlights of my career as a knife thrower or whatever. And if I found out that somebody else got that, I would have been really upset because, I mean, that was a big deal for me, man. And that's a big feather in my cap. And I learned a lot and I really enjoyed the experience, you know. Not too many people get to do stuff like that. So that was definitely a highlight for me.
Yeah, it would be for anybody. I think that's really cool. Chase, did your question that you wanted to ask relate to something along that lines or?
I had a question about working with Salma Hayek and working on that set and all that, but I had another question that was sort of more on the historical side of knife throwing, if you want to do that now.
Yeah, I think it'd be a good time to throw that in there. Right. Get the pun, throw it in there.
Yeah. Funny. Yes. So Bobby, in the context of, like, I guess, total history, I heard this posed on another podcast at one point, like, how much of knife throwing was actually like a true mode of combat versus like a sort of either, you know, performative art or, you know, something like that, you know, in context of, do we know?
Yeah, that's most of that stuff, you know, like you see in the movies and things like that, you know, that's just, Hollywood production there.
Yeah.
You know, like when the guy's riding away on a horse and the guy runs out from the barn or something and throws the knife and the guy, you know, the horse is going around a corner and plus the horse is moving away from you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's almost impossible to hit.
Yeah.
And now there are some guys out there, you know, that can throw the knife, you know, a certain distance with no spin. Mm-hmm. And, but it's very hard to do. And that's mostly Hollywood stuff. And, you know, the old adage, you know, never throw your weapon away. That's one thing.
That
and,
was sort of
or
what I was
kind of like bringing a knife to a gunfight type thing.
Yeah.
That's, I don't know of any instances other than, you know, there was one historically documented thing where this guy, Skeeter Vaughn, he was a Cherokee Indian, and he made his throwing knives out of the bayonets that they had. and they were going to try to take out I forget what you call it, German pillbox or something. Anyway, like a little fortification that they had out there, and it was kind of like downhill. And so they were scouting it out, and there were like a guard sitting at the entrance of this thing. Skeeter, it's pretty much documented that he hurled this bayonet from 87 feet, and he hit the sentry in the neck, in the back of the neck with it, and dropped him.
God.
And they rushed in there, and they took over the facility, whatever it was.
That's a hell of a bunker. Throw.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And that's supposedly the only real documented story about someone, throwing a knife in combat.
Gotcha. I know there's a bunch of conflicting stories for the Jim Bowie sandbar fight, but I know one of them, in one of the stories, he supposedly threw a knife at somebody on a horse, but in another story, that never came up. And, that was always my thing is, knives being... they used to be worth, a lot more, everything being, before the age of...
it can be done. Would it be smart to do it?
Yeah.
And, I would say, no. And, gotcha. I know some guys that throw, with no spin and from any distance, within a reasonable amount of distance. And, they have enough power. They could, put a hole in you with one. But as far as it being a practical application for combat, I would say no. And I think a lot of people would agree with me, except for the people that, that think they could pull it off. Because, any sort of combat situation, you don't know what you're going to do until you're faced with that situation,
For sure. Yeah, I know it was fun to, try to picture that situation as a kid, and I know I got in a lot of trouble one time for throwing knives at my playhouse door and put holes all in it and all that. So
and that's one of the fascinations of knife throwing, a lot of people think that they're going to be ninjas or mercenaries and stuff like that, and very few people actually think that that you can throw a regular knife, in competition, when people buy knives from it, blade shows, majority of them, when they walk up to my table and they go, "Well, what's that?" I said, "That's a throwing knife." "Well, why is it so big?" I mean, it's big because, you need something that has weight for penetration. You need to have a little bit of length, for control. And it needs to be somewhat center balanced. I said, not all the time. When you're a little bit more advanced, you can pick up almost anything and throw it. But as a side note here, I'm actually working, I've been working for like since 2022, I'm working for some lawyers out of Miami on a high profile murder case.
Wow.
And I had to do some extensive testing on pig carcasses and to see if I could throw the knife that this girl used that she allegedly threw at her boyfriend in an apartment, and it stuck him in the subclavicle artery, and he pulled the knife out and basically bled out. But her defense is that she threw the knife, and so the lawyers hired me to prove that I could take the knife, the same make model knife that she has, that it could be thrown and stuck into the closest thing that we have to human tissue would be probably a pig carcass.
Yeah.
And so during my testing and filming, they brought a whole film crew down to my area.
Wow.
And I spent 3 days throwing in front of a camera, from different angles and different whatevers to prove that I could take that knife and stick it in a pig. And I stuck it in the shoulder. I stuck a 6-ounce kitchen knife. I stuck it in like 4 3/4 inches.
Wow.
And when she threw it and stuck it on a boyfriend, for lack of a better term, is I think she got, like, it went in like 3 1/4 inches.
Yeah.
So I pretty much proved that it can be done. So their job now is to prove to the jurors that she could do that. And it's very possible that she could do it, because I have taught a lot of women and older people, and a lot of people just have dumb luck, you know, just pick up the knife and throw it the first time and stick it into a target. So it's very possible that she could have done that. But they basically hired me to tell them how I did it and why it would work and stuff like that, as well as to prove on camera that it can work.
That's awesome. I mean, that's pretty cool.
So they'll be going to trial after the first of the year, and I'll have to go down as an expert witness and do all of that stuff in court.
Yeah.
Mm.
I know I've definitely got that dumb luck thing. The first time I pick it up and throw it, it'll stick basically 100% of the time. And then the next 20 throws or so, it bounces off. So
yeah, it's all downhill.
Yep.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Bobby. So I've seen some people do it like now on like YouTube videos and stuff like that. But I got a feeling it's probably a more of a Hollywood thing than anything too. The whole demonstration where you put somebody on the board and you're popping balloons, throwing the knives around them or whatever, around their silhouette. Is that actually a thing, or have you ever done that? Or
I used to throw a couple of years. I threw around my wife at the Blade Show.
Wow.
Not on a wheel or anything like that. Right. And they, it started getting a little dicey with the insurance, because you're in the parking lot out there. And so you have, if somebody gets hurt out there, you got the hotel that you can sue, and you have the Blade Show and the convention center that you can sue.
Yeah.
And so, they asked me to not do that anymore.
Yeah.
And so, that's why I couldn't have people, come up and teach them how to throw there, because I think one year when somebody else was doing it before me, a knife bounced back and hit this kid, and kid was throwing the knife. And I think it bounced back and hit him in the foot or something.
Yeah.
It didn't cut him, but it just, kind of reassured him that it's probably not a good idea to do that out there.
A little too much liability there. But that's cool. Yeah, I didn't know that you'd actually done that. That's always, classic thing you see, and that's really cool.
Yeah, they're not going to sue a poor knife maker. They're going to go for the deep pockets, with the hotel chain and the convention center and the Blade Show.
Right.
And all of that stuff. So,
yeah, that's really cool. I would have liked to. I wish I could have been there to see that in person when you were doing that. All of it's impressive, but that's a whole nother level there when you're, I do not think that I would be able to convince Amy to stand in front of a target and let me throw knives around her.
My wife, it took her a long time before she would stand up there. And then, even then, she had to wear sunglasses because she would blink. Every time the knife would hit the board, she would blink.
Yeah.
And it looked awkward. And so she would wear shades. And so she did it for a few years and everything. And after that, she kind of retired anyway from doing all of that stuff.
Yeah.
But she, she's a champion knife thrower herself. And I tell people, I said, we don't have arguments around our house or, knife fights or anything. I said, because she can pick them up and throw them back at me.
polite arm society is a polite society kind of deal.
Yeah.
Exactly. We're on equal footing around here when it comes to knives.
Yeah. That's awesome. Did you have another question, Chase, loaded up?
One of mine was just, like I said, about working with Salma Hayek, but, we've touched a lot about the, the throwing knife side of things, but, as you've kind of outlined already, you've done a lot more than just throwing knives, especially, you mentioned you did the stock removal method and forging, bladesmith method. So, where are your interests nowadays in terms of like what you like to do? I know you said you're semi-retired.
Well, I kind of, I kind of call myself semi-retired, and I am making right now. I make a few throwing knives for people. I keep a few blades handy for people that haven't been able to get one of my knives over the years, and I'm making kind of smaller boot knife kind of style tactical knives, and I'm making a few larger pieces just because I'm you know, I've got blanks that have been sitting on the wall for 20 years. I've made a few folders over the years, quite a few. I went to Hawaii and spent a week with Ken Onion in 2007. And I also spent time, I think 2005, I went to Rick Hendra's shop. This was when he was literally working out of a old turkey coop. And it was brutal, man. It was snowing up there. They have that big lake effect snow. And, man, I was freezing my butt off there because I wasn't prepared for that kind of stuff. And so, you know, I've made quite a few folders over the years, not a tremendous amount. And so I have a bunch of pieces that I cut out years ago and blades ground and polished. And I always got intimidated with fitting locks. That was always my Achilles heel. And I just hate to ruin a blade, you know, trying to fit a lock up on it. And it just intimidates the crap out of me.
Yeah, all that work, and it's a very fine line between good and
trash. I've thrown a few blades away, and I really wish I could get settled in and, you know, and not be afraid of folders, because I would like to really probably finish out my career making folders. You know, I can sit down and do it and sit down and grind and things like that, you know, and just the parts are smaller and, you know, just easier to manage a smaller shop, you know, just making folders and stuff. But, you know, you yourself probably know better, way better than I do, the headaches that come with it, you know.
Yeah.
That's kind of, I was interviewed by Blade Magazine when I was doing the mid-techs, and they asked me what was the advantages of doing the mid-techs, you know, up in production numbers versus what I was doing. I said, well, when you're doing mid-techs, when you screw up by the numbers. You know, if you screw up, you know, you having something cut out or something, if something gets screwed up, and you know as well as I do with CNC, if something is off, you can sit there and throw $1,000 in the dumpster real quick. And that was the downside of doing semi-production or, you know, production type stuff. And so...
Work in that's batches and mess up in batches.
A small shop where I can just sit there and just, you know, cobble together a few knives, you know, a couple, three knives a month. And, you know, I'd be happy with doing that. It'd fit my schedule. And, you know, I like doing other things now. I've got a lot of yard work and stuff to do. And got that pond back there in the back. You know, I want to go fishing back there. And want to be able to go to the range a little bit more and do some shooting and stuff like that. And, you know, spending time with the rescue dogs, my wife and I, we rescue American Akitas. And so we have four that live with us now that we were foster failures on. You know, we're not very good at fostering. We always end up adopting them. And so, you know, they keep me busy. They keep my wife busy. And you know, I'm getting to spend time with her now that she's retiring and stuff. And so, you know, life's pretty good. I'm just, you know, trying to keep my health going and stay in good health. And if I get this knee fixed, this other knee fixed, it'd be a life-changing deal for me because I hadn't really been able to walk, you know, any distances or anything for probably 5-6 years. And so that's going to be a blessing when I get that replaced. And hopefully I'll get that done after the first of the year, too. And so
that'll
probably help me ramp up my knife production a little bit too. So
I'm sure it would. I hope that happens then, because I'd like to see you ramp it back up. As a matter of fact, we're going to have to do some talking off air. I've got to get a couple of pieces from you. So that some of that stuff you're talking about having stuck back, I need to get my name on some of it.
All right, man. Sounds good.
So you've got probably one of the most unique stories out there. And I'll tell you what, one of the things that I think could be a big help to up and coming knife makers and stuff out there, or I mean, even across other industries, is one of the things I've noticed there was a theme across your story that a lot of people, including myself, are not real good at, is that you seem to be very eager and willing to seek out other people that had knowledge and, you know, and get them to help you and to, you know, to kind of, that's a way to kind of like get you a couple of steps ahead. If you can learn from somebody else and try to learn from their mistakes and stuff like that and get some knowledge. So that, I think that's probably been one of the keys to you having such a prolific career is.
Well, like I said before, I'm basically an introvert, you know. When I'm home and stuff, you know, I don't have a big circle of friends and people popping in all the time. And, you know, I don't like small chat pretty much, you know, per se. But I realized early on that you need to surround yourself with good people. And that's why, you know, my wife even comments, you know, she said, you've got the coolest friends. How in the world did you get all these cool friends? And I said, you know, I choose my friends very carefully. And so I'm not afraid to go out and talk to somebody, and because you never know until you ask, you know, what the if the answer is yes or no, at least you know where you stand at. But I don't think I've ever had anybody turn me down for to help me. And I've probably had more people help me than not had helped me. And most of the time, if they, you know, can't help me, it's because, you know, time restrictions or something on their part. But, you know, they'll help you over the phone or whatever. But I've been offered a lot of to go to a lot of people's shop, and I've taken advantage of it early on in my career. And like I say, yeah, don't ever be afraid, you know, to ask somebody, you know, for some help, or no matter who they are, and I don't care how big you think they are in the knife world, they're just regular people like me and you. And, you know, they, 9 times out of 10, you know, they had to ask somebody when they first started. And so that's why, you know, you see a lot of these guys out there teaching and stuff like that, holding classes and stuff. I kind of wish I would have went that route in, you know, in my later years and stuff. But it's, even when I have people wanting me to teach them knife throwing, it's hard for me to charge people money for stuff like that.
Yeah.
Because I was given so much free information. It just, I don't know, I feel icky wanting to charge somebody to do something that I, you know, that I basically got for free.
Yeah.
And so I just try to pay it forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and there's a whole lot of that goes on in our industry. Thankfully, that's, you know, we've talked about it a little bit before. Like I've not worked in a bunch of other industries like this, but I have a feeling from things that I've heard that is not always the case in every industry. I think it probably is a little more predominant in industries that revolve around like a form of art or creativity. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like when you have people that are true, like artists in an industry, that they're more prone. Cause just like you said, you love it. That's what brings out the, you know, the passion. And so we're all passionate about it. And we all want to talk about it and share. And, you know, I think that stems from the artist / you know, creator side of things, that, you know, if it's an industry where people are, you know, they're just buying a widget and reselling a widget or something like that or whatever, or it's just a, you know, more industrial where they're making parts, but they don't actually care anything about the parts. They just need to make these parts to fill this order for this contract or whatever. Like, they don't have the same passion about it that we do, because we're in love with the actual final product, you know?
That's like Ernie's son said about, you might as well be making doorknobs, you know? There's no soul there. But the thing I tell people about knife making, look at the different style knives you can make. You could become somewhat of a master on drop point hunters, slip joint folders, tactical folders, tactical fixed blades, chef's knives, throwing knives, anything. There's so many facets to the knife industry. Everybody can kind of find their own little niche in there somewhere.
That's right.
And that's basically what I did with the throwing knives. I kind of saw this little niche that wasn't being filled properly. And I kind of jumped in there. It wasn't a money-making thing. And just, you know, Harry McElroy, the guy that taught me, and he used to tell me, he said, I'm not rich, but I'm famous. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And you know, yeah. Everybody, you yep. know, my family, you know, they think when I'm flying to Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York, Miami, or whatever, I'm going on all of these trips and all, you know, they think I'm making money hand over fist. You know, but I'm not, you know, I'm just a regular guy. I'm going there. That's my job. You know, I'm going to go do my job.
Right.
And my job is selling knives. And sometimes I bring home money and sometimes I don't bring home money. You know, there was many a blade shows that I went to where I was going, okay, got the room covered.
Yep.
Okay. We can eat tonight. Yep. You know, okay. I could buy some handle scales, you know, and okay, I got money for the electricity when we get home too. There's been a lot of those, you know, in the early years.
Yep.
And so, but you know, there's a lot of different routes you can take in knife making, and you can put your own spin on just about any style knife, and that's what's going to set you apart from somebody else.
That's right. There's a whole lot of the majority of the basics are the same at this point. I mean, knives have been being made for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years now. So like there's lots of different, and occasionally somebody comes out with something truly innovative, but it's, you know, it really, a lot of it is just putting your touch on it, figuring out your specific design theory and stuff. And just, you know, like you said, kind of carving out a niche for yourself.
And you know, I've never been one of them, but you know, there's tons of people that have, you know, basically created their own style. You know, that you can see that knife across the room and you know exactly whose knife that is. I just never put that much thought into knives, and I've been kind of lucky with you know, being able to make some of the classics, you know, with my little spin to it, you know, but not, I don't really consider myself a full-blown designer. I can design stuff and I have designed stuff. But I'm not a Ken Onion, you know, by any means.
Yeah.
You know, but being prolific like that with, you know, designs and mechanisms and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's definitely a more rare gift or skill set, I would say, is being able to do something truly unique like that. That's not easy to do.
Yeah, that's definitely a gift.
Yeah. Well, this has been awesome. Is there anything that either one of you want to get out and get on in there before we start to wrap up?
Well, you know, if you want to see what I've done in the past, I try to keep my website pretty up to date with, you know, things that I've done over my career. And I have a gallery of, I've made a lot of different style knives and variations of this and that and whatever. So you can go to Branton Knife Works. .com, and I have a video page on there. You can see a lot of video from different television interviews that I've done, and the articles that I've written for Blade Magazine, and I'm actually working on one now for Blade Magazine. Probably be after the first of the year before it comes out, but that's another thing I kind of enjoy doing. And I'm hoping that, you know, they will allow me to continue to write. I want to write about things other than knife sewing.
Yeah.
And I just, I kind of have that little passion. I'm not a great writer, but I'm a good collector of facts. You know, I can find information. I love finding information and learning new things. And so I love researching. And so I kind of get by with the writing part and everything, and all. But I got people that help, you know, help me if I get in a bind with that. But I like to do more writing and stuff, you know, and I got 40 years experience in this stuff. I know a lot of stuff, mm-hmm. and it's just getting it down on paper and getting it out there, you know, and things I think people would find interesting.
Yep. And that's important too, that we pass that knowledge on as we go along. So, and I think you downplayed it a little bit. I've read some of your articles, and I always enjoy them. They're very well written. So,
yeah.
Looking forward to seeing more of that.
For sure. One thing I wanted to toss in here, Bobby, I will include the link to your website and all that stuff in the description of this podcast. So that way, make it easy for people to get to it. But also wanted to mention that Blade Show Tactical at CanCon will be this weekend, November 7th, 2025 in Clinton, South Carolina.
I wish I was running far enough ahead to have a few things to take to something like that. That's pretty local to me.
Yeah.
That's probably
in your neck of the woods.
2.5-3 hour drive. And so that would be cool. And if I could walk better, I would love to go and just, you know, go and shoot some of the guns and things, you know, with the silencers and stuff on them.
Yeah.
And that would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would love to go too, but, the only one of us that will be there of us three is, the man in the middle, Mr. John.
Yeah. Hopefully, my plans are, if I can get my legs working right again with this knee and everything, I'm probably going to be doing more shows, maybe not exhibiting, but you know, I'd like to go to Blade Show Texas, and I'd like to go to one of the California shows mm-hmm. out there and display out there. Or if I can't get enough stuff together, I would like to go and just, you know, get to see my friends and stuff like you and Amy, and finally get to spend a little bit more, get more FaceTime with Chase and stuff. And so I kind of got plans on that. But I got to get these knees working right first, you know, because it's just real awkward, you know, trying to travel and, you know, get through the airports and stuff. And if my plane moves to another concourse, I'm basically screwed, you know.
Yeah.
I'm kind of dead weight in there. And so, but that's kind of plans too. I'd like to do a couple more shows a year other than Blade, where I can walk around or exhibit yeah. or whatever's convenient at that time.
Well, I hope I hope you are able to get that taken care of here early on this coming year and do that. We'd love to see it. So, but, yeah, Blade Tactical will be this weekend. Those of you that are available to go or if you're within driving distance, it's really cool. The knife show part of it's pretty small, pretty low key. They are having a few more exhibitors this year. I can't remember. I feel like they said it was around 30 or so. I think last year it was only like 10 or 15 of us. So I think it's going to be, if I'm not mistaken, about double the size, and it's only the one day on Friday. And then so you can come, you can do the knife show, you can shoot, you can come back the next day and shoot. So
yeah,
it should be pretty cool. And then.
Yeah, I got, you know, Daniel Winkler, Les from Mississippi.
Les George.
Les is going to be there. I think Jason's going to be there.
Doug from Attention to Detail.
Les
Mercantile. Bastinelli.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of others that there's no way I can remember everybody, but
yeah.
The Nottingham Tactical folks will be there. So it's going to be a good crew. A lot of us Southern folks there for sure. So we're going to be representing pretty heavy. So. We got that coming up. And then on that note, guys, what Chase was probably leading up to with that is that we have not done a good job of going ahead and getting a show pre-recorded for next weekend. But I'm going to get with Chase and see. We might actually end up getting to record next Sunday, Chase. We'll see, because we're only going to be there Friday. I think I'll be back by Sunday, so I'll get with you. And we may not have to miss a week, so we'll see. Hopefully not. I'd like to, since we had to miss one here in the last couple of weeks, I'd like to not miss another one if we don't have to. So if worst case scenario, it might end up being a day or two late, but we'll try our best to at least squeeze in something short. We might even try to do like another quick little live one or something where we can, but we'll do a better job with some headphones or something to make it work better. But you got anything else before we wrap up, Chase or Bobby?
Hey, you guys keep up the good work, man. I really enjoy it, and I'm humbled that y'all have invited me to participate in this podcast. It really made my day when you called me. So,
well, we're humbled really that somebody with your experience.
I've been a faithful listener since day one.
Well, we appreciate that. We appreciate all of you guys. Like I said in the beginning, like sometimes it's easy for us to, you know, we're talking to these microphones and we're seeing I will say though, we were looking at some of the metrics and stuff from the podcast, and while our overall numbers are not nearly as high as I would like to be on YouTube in particular, is where I was kind of looking. So on that note, guys, please share it and subscribe on YouTube and stuff. Even if you usually listen to it on audio, if you could subscribe to us on YouTube, that'll just help the channel to grow. But what I was going to say, that our metrics for the amount of engagement that we get for the number of subscribers that we actually have is actually really good. So like, you guys are doing a great job of commenting and stuff and leaving feedback, which is phenomenal. I mean, that's a large part of what we want to do, is create a, you know, just a kind of a hub for conversation within the community here. So yeah, please keep that up. But it wouldn't hurt if we get a few more subscribers too. So if you can help us out on that, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I try to post on Facebook and everything.
We
and
appreciate
try to
that.
Get the word out. Especially the Emerson episode, man. Who in their right mind wouldn't go and watch that, you know?
Yeah, that we brought some star power to that, and I think this will be the same way. So, well, we give them the email, if you would, Chase, where they can send in questions or suggestions and stuff.
Yeah, the email is knifefreakshow@gmail.com with one S, knifefreakshow@gmail.com. Hit us there and give us all your questions, suggestions, knife stories, etc.
Yep, and then go ahead and just might as well, while we're doing it, go ahead and hit your email address too. We've gotten out of the habit of that.
My email address?
For general, like for interest in your stuff, yeah.
Oh, yeah. My website is boatwrightbladeworks.wixsite.com. Jonathan's is mcneeseknives.com. And as Bobby said, his is brantonknifeworks.com.
So we really appreciate you guys. Bobby, greatly appreciated, honored that you came on here and had a chat with us. And maybe we can do it again sometime. And I look forward to you getting patched up and being able to spend some time with you in person at some shows.
For sure.
All right, buddy. Thanks a lot.
Sounds good. We appreciate all you guys. Hope you have a great week.
And let your freak flag fly.